My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. This episode looks at the work and trauma of a combat medic. We discuss the problems he has faced in the past and what the future holds. From battling to save the lives of casualties in the Second Gulf War, to battling PTSD and how a dog saved his life. Episode 14, Richard Mearns. This is Declassified. Richard, you was born in 1981 in Croydon. 20 years later, 2001, you find yourself joining the British Army. Why did you join?
Well, it was a strange one, really. I was in a family full of police and a nurse. Wanted something different, so I went along to a TA training day and thought, well, I'm not doing this for free, but I quite like to do it for money. So I rocked up in Blackheath and signed on the dotted line was the essence of it.
Yeah.
It was just a different adventure, something to give me some new focus in life. I wanted to join the police, but at that point I thought, let's do the army, let's do something different.
Yeah.
And it looked like a good future.
What month was it when you joined?
January 2001.
Oh, right. Okay. So right at the start.
So I went through the whole process, sort of 2000, and all the fitness tests, all down to Purbright, completed all my fitness tests, and then went on into Lichfield in 2001.
Who did you join?
Royal Army Medical Corps as a combat medical technician.
Why is that? Why did you join then?
Well, it started off as I wanted to do something to help people.
Yeah.
I've come from a background of people helping people. So the focus for me was to be able to look after people, save life, and contribute to making sure that the army, as I was joining, was a decent unit. And it was my passion. I'd grown up doing St John's Ambulance and the like.
Okay.
So it was a natural progression for me.
Yeah. And that's the, because you go into careers office sometimes and they're like trying to sway you onto something else. Was you like dogged in that? Or was you
I was very dogged. I wanted to be a medic. What was his name? I can't remember his name now. He's PWRR. He said, oh yeah, join PWRR because you can become a medic within that. And then I went through the whole process and I got to Purbright and they said, well, what do you want to be? And I said, well, I want to be a medic. The officer interviewing me at the time was a army medic, late entry candidate. And he said, the best way to become a medic is to become a medic, not to join the infantry and become a medic. If that's what you want to do, then we'll put you down that line. And I was adamant that the only thing that I was going to do was become a medic. And that's where it began.
Did you enjoy it then?
Yeah, fantastic. It was a great experience from dot to dot. It was just fantastic. I enjoyed every aspect of it.
So you leave. You join up. You become a soldier first.
Yeah.
And then do you then go and become a medic?
Yeah. So you do your basic training. So you do 12-week basic training.
Yeah.
And then you go on to your phase two training. My basic training was up in Lichfield. Where at the time medics and paras were doing their basic, and my phase two was then down in Keogh Barracks near Aldershot, where you then do your skills training, so to become a class two medic, class three medic.
And then what kind of stuff does that, like, is there a hierarchy within that? So like when you're a class two, you're responsible for this, and then you grow into the role.
You progress through the role. So once you've completed your training, you complete every aspect through to supporting the medical team. So you then become part of a medical team, whereby if something comes in as an injury, you can then know your place where you're going to treat it. You then, on top of beyond class two, you have class one medics. So there is a hierarchy, and as a class one medic, you are higher skilled, you've completed more training, you've completed advanced trauma life support training, So there is a clear distinction between the two levels. There's a lot more than sticking a plaster on a cut, but it's not as much as putting a surgical airway into someone.
But you as a class two now, you're competent and qualified, and there's regular training going on, and you're getting the experience.
So after you do your training, you then get posted to a medical unit. My medical unit was up in Catterick, which was 2-4 Med Squadron, which was part of 3 Close Support Medical Regiment. And off the back of that, you then do training day in, day out. Yeah, you count 10 pegs, you also count poles and the sort of standard ordinary day-to-day stuff. But that's also incorporated with doctors giving you training, Class 1 medics giving you training all the time. So every week there'll be some form of training that you will do just to keep on top of your skills.
Yeah. So which were then, I kind of suppose it's a relevant time to jump us then to beginning of 2003.
Yep.
So you was out in the middle of the desert like a lot of us were. Was you feeling confident enough there? Well, obviously, we didn't know what was going to go on and what was going to happen. But did you feel competent as a young, what was you, 22?
About 20, 21, 22, yeah.
Confident in your ability?
Yeah, I knew what my job was and I knew that I could do my job. Mm. I had no question that you put something in front of me, I would have been able to deal with it competently, and I wouldn't have had to turn and go, oh, I'm not sure what to do with this.
Yeah.
I knew that my skills were at their peak at that moment.
Yeah,
and I was part of a medical unit that was able to deal with anything and everything that was thrown at it.
And was you attached then to infantry not infantry, that was the wrong word. Was you attached to a battalion or a regiment?
At that point,
a standalone kind of field hospital?
Yeah, so at that point we were a part of the battle group, the Irish battle group, and we were a dressing station. So the way it forms is you have a regimental aid post, you then have your dressing station, and then you have your field hospital. At the early stages, I think the field hospital remained in Kuwait whilst we were in Iraq. The field hospital remained in Kuwait, and any evacuations from us went back over into Kuwait.
Okay.
So that's how it sort of...
And what's the difference? What was the first thing you said?
Regimental aid posts.
What would that...
So that would be your initial primary treatment.
Like first aid?
So first aid, in essence, so every regiment would have a medic either attached to them or a team medic within their unit.
Yeah.
And that could be infantry, that could be engineers, it could be anyone. There will be someone that's medically trained. And their job is to stick a bandage on, make sure your airway's open, and get rid of you backwards as quick as possible so that you can get the right treatment.
So preservation of life, stop further deterioration, all that kind of stuff there.
And then move that straight back to us. And that, I mean, there were points where that was a matter of 100 yards. There was no sort of significant space at any one point.
Yeah.
And a regional mental aid post doesn't necessarily have to be a set-up tank or anything like that. It can be someone in the back of a Land Rover saying, right, okay, let's whack this on.
Okay.
Right, now let's move them back.
Okay. So we crossed the border, or you crossed the border, you crossed the border. It was about the 20th of March, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Was you right at the front, or was you at the back as a medic? Was you in this? Because we crossed the border, just to recap, we crossed Operation Telic, military operations in Iraq, beginning of 2003. Crossed the border March the 20th. Of that year, from Kuwait into Iraq, and then from you then, mate.
So we went forwards as a whole unit in convoy. Our position within it, I think, it in essence went engineers putting bridges across the trenches that were dug around the border, and then it went tank regiment, infantry units, and then I suppose in some respects it would have been us following that. So I wouldn't say third, but in that sort of
order,
in that sort of order, and our role was to follow on and move with the battle group. Our main target as the battle group was Bajra. That's where we were heading, so we knew where our main supply route was and how we were going to go up and in an ideal world where we were going to plot up our med station when we got there. It's quite bizarre because you only set up a medical dressing station when casualties are in the system. So for the first day, nothing really happened. And the first, I think our first casualty was a sprained ankle. Mm. So when you're moving into a battle,
yeah,
you don't expect your first casualties to be sprained ankles, because your mindset is, right, this is what we're going to be dealing with. And you've focused on what you're expecting. You're expecting gunshot wounds. You're expecting people with significant injuries. And your first casualty is a Brit with a sprained ankle. I think the second casualty was someone with atropine poisoning, because they were dehydrated. And somebody thought they were having the effects of a chemical weapon attack. So they whacked in two EpiPens of atropine, and
which is
to counter the effects of any chemical weapons. It turned out they were just dehydrated, and with atropine it dries you up even more. So all the hydration that they had in them was then dried up even further. So that was our second casualty, which was kind of a secondary bizarre casualty to have coming into your dressing station at that point. It's like, right, okay, when are we going to get the stuff in?
When did it when did the casualties start coming in?
I would say probably about
the battlefield casualties.
Day three they really properly started appearing, coming through the station, getting dropped off by ambulances and vehicles. They were easily they're becoming at that point recognisable as battle casualties, people with gunshot wounds, people with various injuries as a result of combat. And crucially as well, this wasn't just British troops. This was Iraqis as well, Iraqi civilians with injuries that were relating to incidents that had occurred on the ground. Not necessarily as a result of our actions, but as a result of the battle, ongoing battle. And also, civilian casualties had gunshot wounds, because in Iraq, they didn't necessarily have uniforms all the time. So you were getting people coming in who were just people off the street that had got caught in the crossfire.
Well, the southern armies as well, they were just given weapons.
They were
people
they,
in villages and all sorts. They weren't soldiers. They were just given weapons and tanks and told to
get on with it,
fight them lot coming in. What kind of injuries? By the way, if you can hear that over, Ziggy Richard's dog is chewing a massive bone, so we can just hear his crunching of this bone. So I just wanted to let you know it's not poor audio. Back into it, mate. Explain the casualties, what you guys were doing.
So we were
let's talk about British soldiers.
We were receiving
first.
Yeah, so British soldiers, we were receiving people with gunshot wounds, blast injuries from RPGs, sniper injuries from gunshot wounds. And they varied from, if you can have a minor gunshot wound, low-level injuries whereby it hit the person, it had taken a little bit off their arm and almost sort of skimmed them, to significant injuries where they receive a number of rounds and subsequent injuries as a result of that.
And how were you guys dealing with that?
So our role, we would bring them into the dressing station, assess their injuries and triage them, and then it broke up into a treatment area whereby you would then treat the necessary injuries, and that can be as simple as applying tourniquets, applying dressings, removing aspects of the damaged tissue. And we had doctors with us who would guide us through minor sort of debriding of burnt tissue, so that you could preserve the limb, preserve that area of the body that had been injured. We also had a damage control surgery team attached to us, who would, they would in essence take off a limb, the sort of in a real field environment, put people under and remove limbs in order to save the person's life. And that happened on a number of occasions where people had amputations as a result of significant wounds that had been received on the battlefield.
And the civilian population as well as the Iraqi army, I suppose. You said, or you mentioned we were treating those as well.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing.
Yeah, very
priority
similar.
Priority the same?
Very similar. There was no sort of distinguishing factor between, oh, this is a British soldier, we're going to treat him first. If a British soldier came in and their wound or injury was lesser than an Iraqi civilian that had come in, then we would treat the Iraqi civilian first.
Mm.
They're morally, you're going into battle, it's a real difficult area to play with in your own mind, but you know as a professional that your job is to save life, and you save the life of the person that needs it the most.
Mm.
And like I say, morally, the person that needs it the most in your eyes when you're in a moving battle is the British troops. But actually, reality comes forward and you go, well, actually, this person is a person and we have to deal with that.
Mm.
So it's a real, real difficult area to sort of work in.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah. It's there's a bit of conflict within a conflict, I suppose,
yeah,
isn't there?
Yeah, it's a definite moral conflict within it.
But easily negotiable or navigated, beg your pardon, with the fact that if they're worse off, just from a simple triage. You triage it,
yeah,
and you just put it down as a triage.
They are a person.
It. Exactly.
And that's how you dealt with it. And that's how, throughout the whole conflict, that's how we dealt with it.
Mm.
it's very similar to a triage in a hospital here. Obviously, it's a little bit more efficient and you didn't have to wait months for the referral, but you'd get through it and you'd go, right, okay, this person needs treatment. This is what they need. Right, they're going to this area.
Mm.
This person needs to go straight into damage control. They're going there. Didn't matter who they were. They were just at that point. At the point they entered our facility, they were a person.
Mm.
And it's like I say, morally, your job is to save life. And that's what we did. We didn't distinguish between the different countries, the different people, the different milita. We dealt with people as people, because our job wasn't there to make it difficult for them, make it harder for them.
Go on.
I was going to say that one point we had two Iraqi soldiers come in, and they'd in essence been told that we were going to torture them. In their mind's eye, they'd been told that if they came into the arms of the British troops, they would be tortured. And two that came into our facility were screaming and punching, shouting, and we were trying to deal with pretty serious injuries, yet they were still able to continue the fight within the facility until we managed to calm them down and make them understand that our job was to look after them, because that wasn't us. That's not what we do. It's not what we do as British forces. We go out and we look after people. We deal with people. And their well-being is our focus. And that's what happened.
What was the... you personally now, not the... not you guys as a general, but you as an individual, what was the most catastrophic... severe cases that you were dealing with?
Well, they did vary. One that always sits in my mind was an Iraqi officer, I believe. He was in a vehicle that was involved in a drive-by shooting of a British position. They failed in their attempts of the drive-by shooting, and the LSW gunner, the light support weapon gunner on that sentry point, returned fire and injured all three people in the vehicle. All three, from memory, were subsequently fatal. And the one that sticks in my mind was the one who I provided the sort of life-preserving care for, although it was more sort of comforting his death more than anything, was a severe gunshot wound to the head. and body as well. He very much had succumbed to his injuries, but it was a case of your job is to make his death as comfortable as possible.
Well, just to let me understand, were you in like a tent at this point, or are you in what you?
Yeah, so our facility.
This guy's been brought in.
Was made up of a tent, and we would have a reception tent, a treatment tent, a evacuation tent, okay, damage yeah. control surgery tent, and in the later stages we would have primary care and ultimately an almost dental type facility.
Right.
So it was very much
a very basic setup.
Yeah, it was very basic setup. Our kit was in rucksacks that you hung from the poles. Our beds were stretchers on triangle stands, so that you could just pick them up and move people.
Are you working all the time, flat out?
Yeah.
So let's break this down. So the conflict itself lasted about, 25 days?
Give or take, yeah.
Something like that. For that 25 days, are you working?
All the time. It's a 24-hour process. And we're moving with the battle as well. Mm. Once the battle moves, you don't stay in the same place. You have to move forwards, because otherwise you become almost useless stopping point between the battlefield and the field hospital. So you have to move with in essence the front line. You set up a very basic facility, and you have to work within that environment, and you have to work with what you have available to you.
Mm.
So it's a very difficult environment to work in, because you'll receive a casualty, you'll process that casualty, and then you have to then move with the battle group.
Mm-hmm.
So you're always working. We worked out a shift pattern, which, as with over here, to be fair, people in the medical world work beyond their shifts, and that's what happened when you were dealing with stuff. You'd work beyond your shift, but you need to have a rest.
Yeah.
But sometimes your rest is in the middle of the day, where you've got 50 degree heat beating down on you, and you're trying to have a kip, and the reality of it is, well, that it doesn't work like that. Mm. You've got to drink. You've got to keep your water intake up. So the reality of rest between working wasn't
because obviously always there. We had this first 25 days ish, and then we were there for several months after, and it really did heat up.
Yeah,
When you get into like the back end of April and May,
June, it was hitting 55 degrees C, and
especially around buildings and stuff like that, it was severe stuff. It's kind of movers, mate. You got back all your R&R and everything, and back end of 2004, you started feeling not quite right.
Yeah. It was bizarre, because you don't expect anything less, really. You've gone to war. You don't get brought up into the world to go, right, well, my job is to go to war. And end of 2004, I was having horrible, at that point, I was saying they were just nightmares. And just feeling awful.
What can you remember the nightmares?
They still happen now. They're now more described as flashbacks, because actually what they were reliving exact situations that I'd experienced whilst in Iraq, and they were just recounting incidents. And in 2004, I thought, well, what do you expect? You've just been through a horrible environment.
Yeah.
It is atrocious. But you're gonna think, oh, hang on a second, that's not great. You're gonna have dreams about it. You're gonna have nightmares about it, and you're gonna feel a bit sort of meh, and just best way to describe it, you just feel low and down. And
is that because you think it's sorry to interrupt you? Is it because then, from an Is it always after a nightmare? So if you had a nightmare, you feel low, and then if you don't have a nightmare, you feel all right? Or is it just this kind of chronic thing that creeps in that you don't see?
Yeah, it builds up. I didn't want to go out. I didn't want to be outside in public. I'd go to a shop and I'd feel really worked up and hypervigilant and really anxious. In Catterick, there was Tesco's, and we'd always used to go down there, and I was going down and I was going, right, okay, I'm going to pick up some ham and some healthy food from the deli, and then I'd go, right, I'm going to pick up some alcohol, then I'd be like a crate of alcohol, and then head straight back, and that was it. So it was in, hated it. The hypervigilance, which is one of the sort of symptoms in essence of what I now know as PTSD, at that time was just something that, well, what do you expect? You've been in an environment, you've built yourself up. It's one of those things. That's what's happened. Just get on with it. And that's what I was doing. I was just pushing myself through, but there was, now looking at it, there wasn't something normal about what was happening.
Yeah.
Because other people were like, oh yeah, let's go down the pub. And I'm like, well, no, I don't want to really.
You want to sit in your room and
sit in my room and just get pissed and play on my PlayStation or whatever it was I had.
Well, you know, we've touched on this, but if someone's listening to this podcast for the first time, this memory is reoccurring, coming back as flashbacks and nightmares. And was you thinking about it a lot?
Yeah, it was constant. It was always.
Did you feel like you were self-sabotaging with the thought?
Yeah.
Was you feeling like, sorry, because I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I want to bring this up because I haven't brought it up before. Was you feeling like, am I doing this to make myself feel low? Because this is what I'm hearing from people. This is a reoccurring thing where people feel like they're self-sabotaging by putting the thought into their head themselves.
Yeah. You look at it when you're in that situation, thoughts keep popping in your head, and they are real intrusive thoughts. During the day, I was seeing images in my head and just couldn't understand why I was going through them. I was like, well, why are you thinking about that?
Yeah.
Why are you doing that?
Yeah.
You're sweeping up a warehouse. That's what we're doing, sweeping up the hangar and making sure it's clean for the officers to come down and have a cup of tea.
Yeah.
It was just like, why am I thinking, hang on a second, why is this person, but why, he died, shit happens, it was a bloody war, he died, get over it, and I couldn't get away from the fact that no matter how much I tried to move myself on from it, constantly, I'd have, and even now, still, thoughts pop in my head and go, oh hi, this, I didn't die in your mind. I died in life, but I'm still here. And that can be very that can be very difficult to deal with. Sorry.
It's all right.
Yeah, that can be very difficult to deal with when you have those thoughts that pop into your mind, and they don't come in when you're feeling crap. They come in when you're out. They come in when you're walking down the street, and they just rock up. You're like, yeah, cheers for that.
Mm.
And now, although it cracks me, I've come such a long way from it.
Mm.
I can now look back at it and go, those thoughts aren't my control. Those thoughts are because of the situation I was in. I wasn't able to process them as I would normally if I'd tripped down the stairs and broke my leg. I can process that. But those thoughts happened so hard and fast, I wasn't able to.
Did it feel like it was really, like you say, intrusive when you're enjoying yourself and it's a bit of like relaxed time?
Yeah, it stopped.
Kind of alluded to it then.
Yeah, it stopped me going out because I say I could go out and have a few drinks and I just wouldn't be enjoying myself because of thoughts popping in my head.
Mm.
The hypervigilance is an absolute horrendous thing to deal with. Because you're constantly alert, constant alert levels. And for me, that was bizarre because obviously my job was focused on saving life. yet obviously you're aware of everything going around you. You're doing security patrols whilst you're there. So when you're treating people, you're treating people. When you're off duty, you're trying to have a rest. But then in between that, you're also doing stags around the facility, making sure it's safe. So you're always constantly on alert. And it's only more recently when someone pointed that out to me as to why I'm constant all the time and running at 1,000 miles an hour is why you sort of step back and go, right, hang on a second. This is why this has happened.
I mean, it took a long time for that, though, to happen.
It wasn't overnight.
Yeah, and to end of 2005, you left the army. Yeah. Did you do it? Why did you do it?
So
the actual...
So the reason I left, and it's quite funny, because I was looking through my documents the other day, and it said, I want to join the police. And yet, they weren't wrong. I wanted to join the police when I joined the army, so it wasn't anything wrong with that. But the reality of it was, I was struggling. I didn't know where to turn. I didn't know who to speak to. Everyone was like, right, we're going to do this. Let's go out on the piss. I was going out on the piss and going off out into Reading and just not enjoying myself. But then someone got injured whilst we were out. So we came back into camp. I grabbed the keys to the med center. I then stitch up a hand and then I'm normal. And then that's it. I'm fine kind of thing. It's like, because that is what's been ingrained into me. I just wasn't enjoying anything. And everything just lost all focus, lost all want, all sort of devotion to what I was enjoying. Don't get me wrong, the army is fantastic. I really enjoyed every minute of it, even the rubbish, crappy bits. They're great fun. Sitting in a hole in the snow is bizarrely fun, looking back at it.
Yeah.
Obviously, at the time, it's hell on earth. But but looking back at it, I did not enjoy it. And then, like I say, and sort of, 2004 onwards was a real struggle. I didn't know what to do and how to deal with things. And there was I was a medic in a med center and I didn't know where to signpost myself. I didn't know where to look, didn't know where to turn. People would go, oh yeah, what about speaking to the padre? And you didn't speak about it. It wasn't the thing to do. It was never something you spoke about. Why would you speak about it?
Yeah. When you left then, you joined the police?
Yeah.
And how long did you spend in there? 8 years?
It's about seven and a half years in total in the police service.
And do you think that made it better or worse?
It probably didn't help it. I dealt with all sorts from, again, it's weird because it probably didn't make any sort of benefits from it. But I dealt with a four-day-old baby that had died through to someone else that had been brutally murdered. And looking back at it now, probably not the best thing to have done.
Yeah. does that really care?
No. Bizarrely. I mean, it's there, but why wouldn't it be there? But it at no point has that, and this is the surreal thing, is no point has it come into the forefront and gone, oh, hang on a second. I'm that lady laying on that floor. I'm that baby held in their mum's hand. I don't look at it like that. I was able to process that. Yet constantly niggling at me, the people that I let down, the people that I failed to save whilst I was in Iraq. And they're the ones that really keep digging into me and just popping up and going, hi, I haven't forgotten about you. And they're the ones that make it difficult. And whilst I was in the police, great job, again, but uniform to uniform, the police support structure will fall down at some point because it's not in place, same as the military. There's no real signposting. It's probably going to change now, but there's going to be a lot of people out there that struggle. I mean, simple things. I realised that I was struggling whilst in the police, I think, give or take, 2009.
With the PTSD?
Yeah, 2009, I was really psychologically struggling with everything. It was, at that point, I didn't have a diagnosis. And it wasn't until somebody said, you're right, there's something not right here. You need to get some help. Because I was shouting, I wasn't having red mist because I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
But I was going on scales that were above what were
there
appropriate.
There was just this chronic kind of emotional kind of torment, really, wasn't there? Yeah. That's what it sounds like.
Just constant, yeah. And it was thanks to those people, it was two people that just said, right, you know what, you need to get some help. And somehow I walked into...
the police officers as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow I walked into the occupational health and said, I need some help.
Where did you go?
At that time, I was referred to Combat Stress, who dealt with me pretty quickly. I couldn't tell you the timescales, but I was from, I suppose, referral onwards was a very short period of time compared to what you'd imagine it to be, what you'd think it would be. And yeah, and then I realised that actually I should have put my hand up a lot earlier. I should have said, yeah, I needed this help earlier. But yeah, so the process of the person at occupational health referred me and then going into Combat Stress, I went in for a week-long program and then later a two-week program.
Not the six?
No. The six-week program, I think, would have been great for me, but I couldn't get on it. I was working. I couldn't get the time off. Taboo.
The police wouldn't give you the
time? Yeah, I couldn't get the time off. I asked if I could have 6 weeks off to get the support.
Recover.
And I was basically told, no, you'd have to do it without pay. I tried to say, well, it was an illness. And I was told by my inspector at the time, well, it wouldn't go that way.
Can I ask you a question then? Sorry, yeah, I'm deviating from what I actually wanted to talk about, but this just popped in. If you'd have had a broken leg, would you have...
I would have got paid for...
Full leave.
Before leave.
For more than probably 6 weeks.
For, well, probably months on end, yeah. But yeah, because of the nature of it, I tried to get into it and say, asked multiple times, can I have this time off so that I can go through this program? And the response was, no, we can't give you the time off for that.
You went to Combat Stress and they in your own words, they really looked after you and give you started the process of giving you coping mechanisms and the ability to process and understand what was going on. There was a couple of low points in 2010.
Yeah.
I think you know what I'm
referring to. Yeah.
And if you'd like to.
So I dealt with Combat Stress and I'd come out. And 2010, there was points. The times were ridiculously difficult. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know what was happening. I was employed. I was still a police officer. I'd been dealing with missing persons left, right and centre. And there were two occasions where I got to the point where I considered suicide. One occasion for that, I went and spent two nights in my car wrecking an area to finish it off, because that was all I could see that I could do. That's how I could deal with it. There was no other way out at that point. I was at the lowest ebb. The most difficult aspect of that was 2008. I'd had a daughter, Alexis, and she was the only reason that I'm here at that point. She was always in my mind. I'd split up from her mum, sort of 2009. And so she was young as well. So I then had a little bit of that sort of erring on my side of doubt of my ability. I'd let everyone down. I was letting myself down. And I'd had enough of everything. Everything was becoming too much. And just got in my car and went, right, that's it. I'm just going to have a look at this area. And I went off, I recced it, had a walk round, found the point where it would be okay to do it, where I wouldn't be found by anyone that would be significant, which is horrible to think of. But I wouldn't be found by a dog walker. I wouldn't be found. I would go. And that would be it.
And someone like you would find you, like a police officer.
A police officer, someone who, looking back at it, probably wouldn't be the right person either, but someone of professional nature would find me if they found me.
That makes sense, you know.
Because I didn't want to cause any more heartache to anyone. And, it was a very dark time, and I'd pushed everyone away. I'd pushed family away. The only chink at that point was my little girl that made me go, fucking hell, man, buck up your ideas, get on with this. And that stopped me at that point. That stopped me.
Did those dark times then leave, or was it a process then?
At that point, they...
Was that the lowest?
That was the rock bottom. That was rock bottom. They don't leave straight away once you go, oh, that's it, I've not done it. They don't then suddenly go away. That they take time to work away from. You have to find ways of dealing with times of darkness, for want of a better word. You don't... I mean, I was sitting in rooms full of people, friends, and just feeling alone. And those are the most difficult times over that period, where I could be sitting in a pub and everyone's laughing and joking, and I'm just sitting there trying to engage and just failing in my own mind and just pushing people away.
You said something, because you left the police in 2013 and you became self-employed, and you said in the conversation we've had before, we talked about self-employment. You said something. What was it? What was the phrase you used?
Yeah, it was basically just hiding myself away from everything. Yeah, okay. So I was self-employed because then I didn't have to deal with people.
Yeah.
I just dealt with what I needed to deal with. I just shut myself off from the world. It's without question, looking back at it, self-employed was just self-hiding. It was just getting out of the way. And choosing my work that I chose, because that way I didn't have to deal with people. Didn't have to put myself in situations that I was struggling with.
2015, you contacted veterans with dogs. I suppose life changed quite a lot, and I'm going to just move again. And 2000, so Veterans in Dogs are a great organisation, and they're really impacting those individuals, they're helping. And June 2016, you receive a six-month-old puppy.
Yeah.
And can you just talk about, briefly go over what Veterans with Dogs do and what the start of this relationship was with your puppy?
Yeah, so Veterans with Dogs provide dogs to people with post-traumatic stress in the recovery phase. So if you've just been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, that's not the best time to get a dog to solve your problems. It's part of the ongoing process. It's clear that you can't be given a dog at the outset when you can't even look after yourself. So for me, it was the right point of recovery. It was still difficult. There were still massive downtimes. And I spoke to Veterans with Dogs in 2015, and then in 2016 he was placed with me, 6 months old, like you say, and he just walked into my life and went, you all right? and it changed. From that day, it changed. There were so much positivity, and it gave me a new focus in life. I had my daughter, who was just so switched on, or is so switched on to my PTSD. When the dog came along, it gave us both something to work with and learn together about how to develop it. I mean, she's 9 now, so she was 7.5, 8 when he came along, and she was so involved in him coming into my life. He was, like I say, he was 6 months old. The first thing we did together was try to figure out a new name, because his name was Piran, and I didn't quite understand it, let alone want to be able to shout it in a park. So we sat down together and bashed our heads together. David Bowie hadn't long died, and she'd done an assembly at school on David Bowie, and we were talking about Ziggy Stardust, and then it snowballed into that, and Ziggy worked. And
Ziggy's here.
Ziggy's
making a racket.
Ziggy's
now.
Ziggy's here, ruining a bone behind me.
What does he do for you? As in on a scientific, well, a biological, what does he actually do?
So his job is...
He's with you all the time, isn't he?
Yeah, so he's with me 24/7, unless I decide, right, I can do this without him.
Mm.
And there are times, with my little girl, we'll go to the cinema, we'll sit in a nice, quiet cinema, certain time of day, and we'll sit at the back, no problems. Not because he can't go in, but because I want to push myself those little bits further. He will, firstly, he acts as an emotional support. So when I'm feeling anxious, he will be there and he will recognize my level of anxiety.
How?
Because of the chemicals in my system. Everyone produces chemicals.
Yeah.
Your chemical levels change, and those changes he recognizes. And part of that is because when I was training him, every time I felt rubbish, I would reward him when he'd come up to me. So his reward then became, and that could be food, that could be just praise. So then his immediate reaction is, oh, hang on a second, I smell that smell again.
So he smells the chemical change.
He smells the chemical change, and he comes up and he goes, right, you're right. And he'll lay his head on me, he'll nudge me, he'll climb up on me, and he'll distract me from what's going on.
Yeah.
And that distraction acts as a massive crutch for me, and it stops whatever's happening. Sometimes those chemicals, so if I go to a pub or something, and it's not that busy. And this is the weird part, is it doesn't have to be a busy pub, and I can feel hypervigilant and anxious in it.
Mm.
It doesn't matter what, it could be heaving or hundreds of people, or it could be five or six people. He, in a pub with five or six people, will work just as hard as if there's 100 people in there.
Yeah.
And the last time we were in a pub, stood there, we just got our drinks. I was standing in a position I didn't like. Had my back to the door. I didn't know where the escape routes were, and it's all something that still goes on in my head. But I knew I had Ziggy there, so he was cool. He was sitting there, and he was. But that doesn't stop the chemicals change.
Yeah.
So my anxiety level went up. My chemicals changed, and he rocks up and he nudges me. And I'm like, oh, it's all right, mate. It's all right. We're just having a chat and stuff like that. And he then mouthed at my hand. I was like, no, we're fine. So I chucked him a crisp. So that's it, because he's doing something right. And then he sat there, he nudged me, and he does this great little yap of a bark. And for such a big dog, you wouldn't know where it came from. You just go, well, it weren't that dog, because it's just yappy. But I learned over a period of time, what he's doing is that one bark is, it's time to leave.
Yeah. It's incredible, man.
It's amazing. And without doubt, I can... If I'm with people I don't know, I can go, oh, sorry, he needs a toilet.
Yeah.
And I go out, and he needs a toilet. Most of the time, if I've heard that bark, or if anyone else has heard that bark, he doesn't go out and need the toilet. He goes out, and he turns to me, and he starts playing with me and just bringing me back down to a level. Mm. He won't go to the toilet. It's bizarre. But he does what he does. And... He just changes situations. So I can be in a pub, I can be struggling, and I don't need to make an excuse of, oh, I need to go out. The dog does it for me.
Yeah.
So it breaks down a barrier for me. Other things he does is at night I have a lot of flashbacks, or not a lot now compared to what I used to. From week two of having him, bear in mind he's a six-month-old pup, he woke me up. I was sweating, I was in the middle of a flashback. But he'd gone, hang on a second, there's something not right here. So I rewarded him. I played with him and made it happen, made him happy. And he then used that And then from then onwards, I was being interrupted. He was interrupting my flashbacks. So I wasn't getting a full flashback.
Mm.
And now more recently, he doesn't let the flashbacks happen. He wakes me before them.
Because he
can sense the change in chemicals.
So he can smell the change in chemicals even if he's asleep.
Yeah. He'll
wake him up and then he'll wake you up.
Yeah, and he's always in close proximity to the bed and stuff like that. There was one occasion where he wasn't in close proximity because it was roasting hot. I think he was on the bathroom floor because it's tiled. And he came in the room and I was obviously having a flashback. Mm. And I woke up at the sort of midpoint of this flashback where I'm stood in the middle of Iraq beating heat, treating someone, and then all of a sudden I'm looking up and I've got 35 kilo of dog burying and burrowing his head into my chest to the point where I had scratches on my chest because he's like, get up, there's something not right, get up. And he just works constantly. He's just so life-changing.
So what would have happened before? So, you know, you talk about excluding yourself from things like, and we mentioned pub here. It's not to do with the drinking; it's to do with the socializing, yeah. And you getting out and living a life. What would have happened if you'd have been in that pub before without Ziggy, and then you started feeling that anxiety?
I wouldn't have been in the pub.
Would you not?
No.
So what is he? He's
enabled me to get out and do things like I never used to do. When people at work now go, "Oh, do you fancy going for a drink?"
Yeah.
Obviously, it's still dependent on how I feel.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going to push myself over the edge just so that we can have a couple of drinks in the pub after work. I'm gonna want to assess each situation, but I would be able to now go out and have a drink and pop across to the pub and have a drink.
We, we've had Simon Harmer on, and his prosthetics have given him mobility and independence, and he can go and do what he needs to do. I suppose Ziggy's a bit more like your emotional prosthetic. He's given you your life.
Yeah, he's given me a sense of normality.
Mm.
And not only that, he's also given me the ability back to just go and chat to people, to open up and go, you're right, how are you getting on? At work, I think best part of 80% of people don't know my name, which isn't a bad thing, but they know Ziggy's.
Yeah.
But you know what? It doesn't matter that they don't know my name because I can stand in the kitchen, make a cup of tea, and I can talk to people.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I wouldn't have done that. I would have just made a cup of tea, gone back, sat down, hidden away. So he's made a huge difference. And to say he saved my life as well, I don't doubt that, because even with him, I've had dark times, but I've got through them because he's been there for me. And he's also opened up people's understanding that this invisible illness that is PTSD is actually real. Mm.
Do you tell people, because it's invisible, do you tell people why Ziggy's with you?
Sometimes if they deserve to be told, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people look at him and go, he's a guide dog because he's yellow lab.
Yeah.
So I just go, whatever. Don't bother me. I'm not going to justify
it. Yeah.
Bizarrely, one person in the park the other week, I took his jacket off. Oh, what's he do? And I showed real interest. I told them. And it turns out everyone's a psychologist nowadays.
But listen to this podcast, mate.
because that's it. Reading his tweets. Because apparently I should be doing art and various different things, and I should be more free-spirited and shouldn't be tied to the regime and all this sort of stuff.
I mean, look, I think that goes to show that there's a bit of ignorance. Loads of people need educating, which is great. Why you stopped them and chat with them. And not everything works for everybody.
No.
Art works for some people.
Absolutely.
You know, having a great assistance dog there.
And don't get me wrong, she's not wrong. I've painted a few things. Do you know what I mean? Because there are times where you just want to switch off and look at one thing and just give it a go. And there is stuff out there. A dog's not necessarily the right thing for everyone. There's always something out there. But I think it's crucial to be able to, and looking back at it, to be able to stand up and go, hi, I need help.
Yeah.
I'm struggling. I want help. And I think that's the biggest factor for me is looking back, recognising that I was struggling. If I'd asked for help at 2004, probably wouldn't need to be sitting here now going, oh, I've had an issue. I could have probably been in a better position of been dealt with it and had it sorted, in want of a better word.
You know, today's been tough. We've heard it in your voice over the last kind of 55 minutes. There's a reason why Ziggy's got the bone, and that's to distract him, because he would have been tugging at you and barking and all sorts with the rising stress. And I really appreciate you coming on and speaking to us so kind of candidly about it and really open and honest. Do you have anything else to kind of add? What's from there?
No, I mean,
you've really covered a lot of ground, mate.
Yeah,
you've
think
done great.
There's no doubt it's not easy talking about it. And I always push my limits. Ziggy's given me the ability to push my limits. I think it's key that everyone gets the message that, although it's invisible, it is there, and actually talking about it and keeping the conversation going is the most important thing, because everyone chats about stigma. The stigma is 10% everyone else, 90% yourself, in my eyes, because you're the one that needs to say there's something wrong. And that's the hardest part, be it compared to Alcoholics Anonymous, the hardest part for an alcoholic is to stand up in a group and say, I've got a problem with mental health. That's the hardest thing, because, I think one sort of analogy is, if I rocked up to work after being run over by a bus and losing my leg, I'd rock up into work and go, morning. Someone would look at me and go, God, you're right. Oh, we need to get you some help. I rock up to work feeling crappy and I go, morning. They go, morning. That's it. But actually, the conversation needs to start with yourself, and you need to say, morning, how are you? And then that will be reciprocated. And then when they say, oh, not bad, thanks. You go, well, honestly, I'm not all right today. And that's where it starts.
Having someone you can trust and speak openly about is really, really key. And even if you haven't got that person, there's support lines like the Samaritans, like the numerous veterans helplines. I'm just looking at him now, and he's there for you all the time. And he knows without speaking when you're having a bad day, and he gives you a nudge. And I'd like to thank, firstly, Ziggy, for bringing you here today. And Rich, I just really thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
So it's been a pleasure. It's been very difficult. But
mate, we will leave
Thank
it
you.
There.